From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
Say, Charlie Brown, I've got a football. How about practicing a few place kicks? I'll hold the ball, and you come running and kick it.
Oh, brother. You must think I'm stupid.
Oh, come on, Charlie Brown.
No.
I'll hold it steady.
You just want me to come running up to kick that ball so you can pull it away and see me land flat on my back and kill myself.
This time you can trust me. See? Here's a signed document testifying that I promise not to pull it away.
It is signed. I guess if you have a signed document in your possession, you can't go wrong. This year I'm really gonna kick that football.
Peculiar thing about this document, it was never notarized.
You know another year has turned when Lucy, ever the innocent, shows up with her football and finds yet another way to do in the hapless Charlie Brown. He always falls for it, and we always smile. Charlie Brown's creator, Charles Schulz, knew we would.
If someone says to you, "Boy, I feel just like Charlie Brown today," you know how he feels. And all of a sudden it occurred to me, after all of these years, this could be the reason for Charlie Brown's existence.
Today we'll find out how Charlie Brown became such an icon in America, and check out what else we've raised to that lofty cultural status. A new graphic novel suggests one cultural touchstone whose name we never knew is Laika, the little dog the Russians sent into space. We'll hear her story today. And then there's that titan of American architecture, Frank Lloyd Wright.
Wright is the most written about artistic figure in the West since Michelangelo.
But it turns out there's more to his story than you've ever heard, and it's downright shocking. But let's start with good old Charlie Brown. Charles Schulz made him the central figure of a squat, space-saving comic strip launched in 1950, and syndicated in newspapers under the title Peanuts, a title that Schulz hated, according to his biographer, David Michaelis. In his book Schulz and Peanuts, Michaelis shows how a barber's son from St. Paul, Minnesota, became the most famous and richest cartoonist in America. Michaelis told Steve Paulson that from the beginning, what Schulz did in his strip was revolutionary.
Within the confines of a comic strip, Schulz broke out to expose all of our emotions in ways that were unexpected for the time. When Charlie Brown said, "I'm depressed," he was really opening up a taboo subject. And I remember the young man, now grown up, who played the part of Charlie Brown in the first Charlie Brown Christmas special, remembering that when he spoke that word, when he said as Charlie Brown, "I'm depressed," he felt a little scared. There was something scary about it. It was adult. It was taboo.
"I think there must be something wrong with me, Linus. Christmas is coming, but I'm not happy. I don't feel the way I'm supposed to feel. I just don't understand Christmas, I guess. I like getting presents and sending Christmas cards and decorating trees and all that, but I'm still not happy. I always end up feeling depressed."
Charlie Brown, you're the only person I know who can take a wonderful season like Christmas and turn it into a problem.
Maybe Lucy's right. Of all the Charlie Browns in the world, you're the Charlie Browniest.
You would have to go in those days, in the early to mid-50s, to a nightclub to hear someone like Mort Saul talk about those kind of feelings. But here was Schulz in the mainstream comic pages opening us up to our feelings of not fitting in, of not belonging, and of indeed being quite beaten up. I mean, Charlie Brown is an object of cruelty in those early strips, i.e. 53 to 58. Wow, it's shocking, actually, how much abuse he takes and keeps on going.
Right. I mean, this is, to some degree, a strip about failure, about rejection, about heartbreak, and as well as about depression.
And loneliness. I mean, there's one where Charlie Brown is with Shermie, who has an enormous railroad track, and Charlie Brown is being completely ignored by his friend, and back to his own house he goes. And in the final panel, he sits with his own railroad track, which is a single circle. It's about no bigger than a manhole cover, a single closed track, and there's no words in the whole strip. Just Charlie Brown sits down next to his own tiny little, almost meaningless railroad track and has to just bear being Charlie Brown. It's one of the loneliest cartoons ever drawn.
Was Peanuts a big hit from the get-go, from when the strip started in 1950?
No, people were confused. There were too many characters. They didn't quite know who these little beings were who were in child bodies but spoke like adults. They just weren't yet the Peanuts gang that people came to know later on. And Snoopy wasn't really Snoopy until, of course, he began to think his thoughts. And well, until he actually got up on four legs first. And then when he began to think his thoughts in the 60s, then things were blown wide open.
Oh, that's interesting. So Snoopy, as we know him today, really didn't emerge for at least a decade.
He was the slowest of all the characters to emerge. In fact, he went through a long period in the 50s of being quite a wonderful little character, kind of a comic, a silent comedy figure, where he would turn his body into different shapes, you know, an aardvark or a vulture, and amuse the other characters, even doing an impersonation once of Mickey Mouse.
Well, some people have argued that Snoopy is the real hero of Peanuts. I mean, everyone sort of assumes that Charlie Brown is, you know, the lonely-hearted guy who keeps getting rejected. But where do you come down on that?
Well, the formulation that Schultz, I think, agreed to when he was alive was that Charlie Brown was who he was and Snoopy was who he wanted to be. And I think in Snoopy there's a richness that you don't see in any of the other characters. Snoopy is so finely tuned in the beginning to have these two sides, which is he's a dog, but he always wants to be something else. And he has a great goal and a quest to be something much greater than he really is. But of course, he's always brought back down to the dog dish. And in that deflation to dogdom, he then becomes dependent again. And he's dependent on Charlie Brown for food. And he's not what he wants to be. And I think that makes for a great deal of drama and also a great deal of humor. And Schultz always said that drama and humor come from trouble and sadness and mankind's astonishing ability to survive life's unhappiness. And I think he had an acute sense with Charlie Brown of life's unhappiness. Somehow Snoopy was the transcendent figure. He was going to keep transcending unhappiness to become what we all want to become, which is our grandest self. But then, of course, life would happen again and he would be brought back down to earth.
How much of Charles Schultz do we see in this comic strip?
Well, it's a great work of art, so I wouldn't want to take away from the mystery of the creativity that Charles Schultz brought to an otherwise fairly commercial medium. I think he did transcend his medium. But like all artists, I think he was bringing into the strip, let's face it, there's 17,897 strips, and it's a very personal cartoon compared to, oh, Dagwood and Blondie or The Gag-A-Day of Beetle Bailey, to take nothing from Mort Walker and his artistry. But here's a man who's actually trying, in some cases, to render comic strips without words. There's an entire body of Peanuts that's just silent. Here's somebody who's doing things with melancholy, harmonizing it, and creating a sound that has no bearing whatsoever on the comic's pages. But Schultz had to bring his own life in because it was so personal and because he was drawing it every day. And indeed, one finds it was one of my great surprises was to find how much of Schultz is in the story.
Are you talking about the melancholy that we see in Charlie Brown in particular? Is that essentially Charles Schultz was himself?
Well, I think he had great joy and great sadness. I think he recognized life for what it was and for the fact that we can find its glories in recognizing melancholy and joy. I think he was always contradictory in some ways, which is to say that Peanuts itself celebrated contradictions, celebrated ambiguity. I think he himself was a contradictory person. And when you find, for example, or when I found, for example, a day where I kept noticing things like suddenly there'd be a strip in which Snoopy in the series would be chickening out from going to give a speech at the Daisy Hill Puppy Farm. And this would dovetail with my sudden or new or growing appreciation of the fact that Schultz himself did not like to go and give speeches. It made him uncomfortable. He felt fearful, far away from home. He only liked to be as far from home in a given day as the distance that would return him that night to his own bed. He had his own timetable that he kept to, and he had his own world that he wanted to live in every day. But more, I think, it's simply a matter of outlook. I mean, the kite-eating tree, Charlie Brown at Christmas, Snoopy being shot down, none of the characters ever finding true love. They're always looking. Every ball game is lost. There really isn't finally even anyone in the universe, any higher power beyond something called the Great Pumpkin, which, as we know, just doesn't ever arrive, doesn't ever come. I think the question that is so interesting about Schultz's universe is why aren't there adults? And I think that one of the reasons there aren't adults is because Schultz learned early on that you don't get the answers from adults. They don't give you real answers. They don't tell you the truth.
Treats. Halloween is over and I've missed it. You
match with a blockhead.
You owe me restitution!
Well, what's always been puzzling about Charles Schulz is that by all outward appearances, he didn't seem like a very interesting man. I mean, he seemed, I don't know, kind of too normal in a way.
Well, it's interesting you say that because he would say very self-deprecating things about himself. He'd say, well, he remarked once that he thought he looked like a dentist, or he would say quite frequently, I'm just an ordinary Midwesterner, or he'd say, you know, I'm a non-entity except that I draw, or I'm really just a nothing young man from St. Paul. He was constantly making himself appear to be just ordinary, when in fact the record of his life suggests that he knew himself to be extraordinary, but had been told from day one, even when he was nicknamed Sparky and therefore given a kind of identity that had some specialness because it had to do with the comics, which were the great entertainment medium of his childhood, the great popular entertainment medium with the movies and radio. And I think he felt a sense of specialness as he learned that he was someone who had a talent for drawing. But his father, like so many around him, was not encouraging or was simply indirect in their discouragement by saying, don't get a big head about things, you know, don't feel too good about yourself.
Right. Well, it's that old Midwestern mantra, don't get too big a head, which, you know, to some degree, some of his characters rebel against, especially Snoopy, who is the epitome of rejecting that whole philosophy.
And literally, Charlie Brown has an enormous head, and it's placed on a small body to be unthreatening. And yes, Snoopy is the great... Well, even Charlie Brown, when he begins, actually has a moment or two of grandiose thinking where he wants to be president of the United States and or a five-star general and or a big man, as he puts it, and then discovers his father himself would not vote for him. Charlie Brown's father was a barber and discovers that his dad, says, sure, you can run for president. I don't think I'll vote for you. But the great understanding of Charles Schulz by his friends and by people who'd known him was that he didn't change, that he never changed.
Charles Schulz finally opened up to the media shortly before he died. He was interviewed by Al Roker for the Today Show, and he broke down on camera. What do you make of that moment?
Well, there was one person only who wanted to do the interview with Al Roker, and apparently it was Schulz himself. He wanted to go out and say farewell or have his final say.
It's hard for me to remember, but it didn't really sink in until I was writing a little kind of a so long friends, you know, sort of thing. And then right at the end, I wrote his name, my name, and then it said, and I'll probably start crying. he said, well, that was Charlie Brown, minus and so on and so. And all of a sudden I thought, you know, that poor kid, he never even got to kick the football. what a dirty trick. He never had a chance to kick the football.
I personally think you see on there someone who is connecting with himself and his reader one last time and giving his real feelings about things. It's been roundly disputed, but my personal feeling, knowing the man to the extent that I did after 7 years, it seemed to me he was speaking from his heart.
David Michaelis is the author of Schulz and Peanuts. He talked with Steve Paulson. Even years after we've seen the films, movie music can magically transport us back to those intimate encounters with larger-than-life characters on the silver screen. So, with that in mind, here is a musical montage of some cultural touchstones from the cinema. A whirlwind tour through 5 of the 20th century's most famous films. Thank you.
just when you thought it was safe to go back in the water.
Thanks to our producer, Doug Gordon, who assembled those musical touchstones. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. It's hard to remember the hysteria that surrounded the early days of the space program. This was at the height of the Cold War, and we were all worried about Soviet rockets up to no good over our heads. Sputnik, the first capsule to orbit the Earth, was a huge propaganda triumph for the Soviets, as well as a scientific advance. The Russians were eager to repeat their success, and this time Sputnik would have a passenger. No one dared risk a human being, so the Cosmodog program was born. Nick Abadzis grew up on stories about the space race. Now he's drawn a graphic novel about the Cosmodog who ultimately rode Sputnik to the stars. Abadzis told Anne Strainchamps about Laika.
Laika was known to be a stray who was collected from the streets of Moscow and inducted into the nascent space program, the Cosmodog program. That part of the book is imagined biography. When I went to Moscow, I saw a great many strays on the streets, so it's actually not that difficult to imagine what her life might have been like.
She emerges as such a strong and lovable character. I mean, I guess from the very beginning, the story of the dog you tell, she's a stray who's mistreated in several different ways. I mean, her life is threatened from the time she's a puppy. And instead of turning her mean, she just becomes this extremely loving little dog.
Well, she's on record as being this incredibly calm character. And I guess I felt I needed to, I didn't need to, but I wanted to provide some sort of explanation for that. I don't know what makes a dog, or a cat, or a human. Who knows what makes us the people we are? But it's on record that she was this very, very cool, calm, and collected dog. She was the one that put up with the training, the best of all of those dogs. So that's why she was chosen for the mission.
There's kind of a lovely sequence of panels that gets repeated thematically several times during the book that shows Laika, this dog, just kind of heading out into space, you know, without not in a capsule at all. She's just kind of traversing through the stars, past the planets. Where did that come from?
That, I suppose, is pure me, the romantic side of it. I mean, Laika's become this sort of pop cultural icon. Whatever the real reasons, the facts that she ended up on in a satellite, she is also the first living being from this planet to orbit it and, you know, to go out there amongst the stars, which makes her unique. So the fact that she has become this kind of pop cultural icon is pretty incredible. And I remember as a child feeling this awe that this little dog had been the one to do that. So I guess that's almost an answer to my child self, my desire to, I think, to kind of to look at it from that point of view. I wanted to portray a great many different points of view and not state that anyone was particularly correct or that all these things are real. They're all part of the phenomenon of Laika.
Is she still out there?
No, she fell to Earth in 1958 when Sputnik 2 came down. It burned up on re-entry. It wouldn't have stayed up there forever. The orbit decayed. So she came down to Earth literally as a shooting star at the end.
It's such a sad story. you know, and such an outrageous story. This adorable dog sent out in space, and they knew she wouldn't come back, right?
They did know, yes. There are numerous explanations provided as to why that occurred, chief amongst them being that the time Korolyov was given to put the mission together was literally a month, which would be incredible by today's standards, let alone back then. Just absolutely no time to prepare at all.
Why was he only given a month?
Khrushchev wanted to put a second satellite up after he realized the propaganda impact of the first. And he wanted it to chime with the 40th anniversary of the revolution. So
this was all for publicity reasons. Khrushchev just wanted to rub the Americans' nose in it.
Pretty much, although there was real scientific data gained from the mission, which helped eventually Korolyov to put Yuri Gagarin into orbit. Once they'd put Laika up there, they knew that it was possible to do that for a man also. But yes, that is one charge that could be leveled at them.
So because of the short period of time, they decided this would have to be a one-way mission. The dog wouldn't be coming back?
Effectively, yes, that's the case. I mean, the world at large at the time was outraged by this, and I think the Soviets were somewhat taken aback by the criticism leveled about them at that. But in the end, it was all good publicity for Khrushchev, for the communist cause.
Hmm. There was a big hue and cry about the dog. I don't remember any of that.
Apparently there was. Eisenhower ended up noting in his memoirs a few years later, I can't remember it verbatim, but it was words to the effect of how strange it was that the death of the dog actually ended up almost overshadowing the incredible technical achievement.
The passage is once Laika gets out into space, and, you know, there's a two-page spread in particular where she's in space and she's dying, are really, they're even hard to look at. They're painful, sort of agonizing and sad. I mean, this book made me cry.
Oh,
did you have that?
I'm sorry.
Well, I assume you sort of meant it to make people cry, didn't you?
I wanted you to feel that it was an insight into what it might have been like in the capsule. Of course, it's all imagination. It's based on the evidence that I have. It's based on everything that I had to hand about how she died, and yes, it moved me greatly. I did feel that awe that I mentioned earlier about the fact that she was the first living being in space, but there was also, when I boiled it down, the sense of this little animal out there, very lonely, and that moved me. So yes, those emotions certainly register, you know, through the end of the pen, through the line that you weave, and the fact that it's there on the page and you read it that way means that I was definitely successful in communicating that, and thank you for that.
Nick Abadzis is the author of a graphic novel called Laika. He talked with Ann Strangechamps. If there's a way to make a living from music without actually being a musician, Ashley Kahn has done it. He's a music historian, journalist, producer, radio commentator, and road manager. He's written countless newspaper stories and magazine articles about music, and several books, including Kind of Blue, The Making of the Miles Davis Masterpiece. Since we're talking about cultural touchstones today, and since Kind of Blue remains to this day one of the best-selling jazz recordings of all time, Steve Paulson asked Ashley Kahn to tell him about that album.
It was an experiment by Miles Davis to try and liberate jazz musicians from what he thought was very sort of a cliched bebop-driven path of what was called playing chords, playing on the chords of bebop. And so that ferocity that Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie and that creative fire, he sort of pours a sort of antifreeze on, so to speak.
And it's worth pointing out that Miles Davis came out of that tradition. I mean, he'd played with those guys.
Absolutely. I mean, he wanted to be a Dizzy Gillespie player. He wanted to be up in the higher register of the trumpet playing these incredible runs. And there's that famous statement he makes of when he talked to Dizzy. He said, how come I can't play like you? And he goes, Dizzy says, because you don't hear it that way. And Miles, in finding his own tone, which was very vibrato-free, very dry, very cool, very late night, found the perfect home to it around the mid-50s, especially with the arrangements of Gil Evans, etc., but then off on his own in a small group setting with an unbelievable sextet, I mean, just exploding with talent. John Coltrane, Bill Evans on piano, helped compose some of the tunes for Kind of Blue, Wynton Kelly playing piano and Freddie Freeloader, Paul Chambers and Jimmy Cobb, you know, his rhythm section, and Cannonball Adderley, who is probably the most connected to the bebop runs that I've been describing, that bebop flavor on alto. There was no way he could miss. He was going to make a great album with his sextet. The fact that he was going to make an album that would be still a bestseller 40 years down the road is just an incredible comment on what they were able to achieve in a most spontaneous, offhanded way.
So what he was doing in reaction to the bebop of that time was he was producing a kind of minimalist music, I guess, that had an almost hypnotic effect.
Bingo. I couldn't say it better myself. I mean, he really was going for that sort of trance-inducing, yet at the same time, something that would force an in-the-moment creativity, a spontaneity that would challenge the most veteran or the most improvisatory of, you know, jazz geniuses out there.
What was Miles Davis like as a band leader? Was he a dominating figure?
In the most passive of ways, he was a dominating figure. He loved throwing surprise and chance into the music. And one of the perfect examples is on Kind of Blue, when he has Bill Evans as pretty much one of the driving forces creatively, compositionally, and then performance-wise on the album, basically show up at the studio. Now, he had been out of the band for about 4 or 5 months at the time. He had already hired Wynton Kelly to fill the piano chair. Never told Wynton. So Wynton arrives at the studio, and suddenly there's this feeling, oh, my God, did I just lose the chair? What am I doing?
So Bill Evans is there when Wynton Kelly walks in.
Yeah. So there was a little bit of, you know, I think it was Jimmy Cobb who says that he went up to Wynton and says, don't worry, you haven't lost a gig. Just play it through. Let's see what happens. But of course, what that's going to do is going to spark some sort of challenge, some sort of like, okay, I'm going to show Miles. I'm going to show him what I can do. And that's exactly the type of energy that Miles would feed off of. And it certainly shows. I mean, the first tune they actually recorded that day on March 2nd, 1959, was Freddie Freeloader, which was Wynton's chance to shine. And boy, does he shine. I mean, he makes that tune.
Did Miles give explicit directions to the band in terms of how they should perform these pieces?
Would be more like explicit suggestions. Cannonball Adderley talks about he would listen to what was happening. I mean, he would, you know, explain the shape, the structure of the piece. They would go through it once, and it would be more like he would go over to Cannonball and say, you know what, I don't want you to do this. It wouldn't be him saying what he wanted Cannonball to do. More, don't go in this direction or add this or whatever. There's this moment on the tape for Kind of Blue where at last minute, Blue and Green, it's as calm and serene as like a pond, you know, in the middle of a forest with nothing to disturb it, just like mirror-like surface to it. That's how that small piece feels. It's about 5 minutes long. And last minute, you can hear him asking Coltrane to play on it and play part of the solo. It was meant to be just a quartet piece, but he adds Coltrane in at the last minute. And, you know, a lot of his creative ideas were just these last minute suggestions.
You've said that a lot of this music was improvisation, which I've always been fascinated by, because I don't exactly understand why, when you have six wonderful musicians all playing together and they have not carefully rehearsed things, why doesn't it all just descend into chaos?
I think that's as much a comment on the ability of these musicians to make the music that, you know, that is appropriate to the structure that they've been presented with. That language, no matter what the chordal structure underneath it is something that they've come to understand and come to know. One great example on Kind of Blue is the way that you hear the transition on Freddie Freeloader from John Coltrane's solo to Cannonball solo. And you're going from a tenor sax to an alto sax, and yet the transition sounds so natural, so unforced, that it could almost be the same person, at least for a moment or two, that has, like, dropped one instrument and picked up another. Coltrane knew Cannonball as Cannonball knew Coltrane. And I think that has as much to do with it as their own personal prowess on their instruments.
Kind of Blue is obviously Miles Davis's statement, his musical statement at the time, but didn't the pianist Bill Evans also have tremendous influence on at least a couple of these compositions?
Tremendous is probably the best way of putting it. Without Bill Evans, Kind of Blue just would not have been what it is. As a friend, as a colleague, as a fellow musical explorer with Miles Davis, he turned Miles onto a lot of classical music that was based on the idea of scales rather than chord progressions. And that inspiration definitely, you know, fills the creative sail, so to speak, on a lot of the compositions, especially So What, and in the biggest way, Flamenco Sketches, which is based upon a continuing cycle of five different scales. The other aspect is, of course, Bill Evans' own piano playing, which Miles, you know, who is not one given for poetic language, but in his own autobiography would describe Bill's piano playing like a crystal waterfall. Yet Miles was driven. Miles was committed. Miles wanted to include this element into his music. So on the bandstand of 1958, Bill Evans lasted about 8 months with his sextet, he made that a part of the Miles Davis sound. Kind of Blue is like his revisitation in the spring of 59 to the magic of 58. He wanted to get it done in the studio, and he wanted to get that Bill Evans, Miles Davis sort of dialogue happening in the studio. And thank God he did.
Ashley Kahn is the author of several books, including Kind of Blue, The Making of the Miles Davis Masterpiece. He spoke with Steve Paulson. Have we overlooked your favorite cultural touchstone? Let us know at our website. It's ttbook.org. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Whenever you see a residential building that settles into its site, that celebrates the horizontal and seems to bring the outdoors inside, you're looking at the legacy of the Frank Lloyd Wright Prairie House. Perhaps the ultimate expression of the Prairie House was the original Taliesin, the house Wright built to share with his lover, Mamah Borthwick Cheney. But it was not meant to be. Taliesin became the site of a massacre. When it was over, 7 people were dead, including Mamah, her children, and several of Wright's workmen, while little remained of the house but a smoking ruin. And Wright's architectural style was changed forever.
The Prairie House died in 1914 with Mamah Borthwick Cheney.
You'd think such a scandalous story would be the first thing everybody associates with Frank Lloyd Wright. William Drennan, author of Death in a Prairie House, Frank Lloyd Wright and the Taliesin Murders, told me why that's never been true.
The murders have attracted scant attention from Wright's legions of biographers. Most biographers seem anxious almost to pass over the unfortunate incidents of the summer of 1914 in order to get us to look forward at the great man's subsequent production, Falling Water, the Guggenheim, the Imperial Hotel, and so on.
To tell the story, we really have to start at the beginning. At the turn of the century, Frank Lloyd Wright set out to create a new vision for how we could live. Drennan says he had opinions about everything.
Wright was chiefly thought of philosophically, if not architecturally, as an aficionado of all things domestic. He had made family life a kind of substitute religion.
As the arts and crafts movement was shaping American style, Frank Lloyd Wright became the hot young architect, and he began to attract the attention of the wealthy and fashionable. Soon, he had a number of clients in the Chicago suburbs.
Edwin and Mamah Cheney commissioned Frank Lloyd Wright to design a house for them on East Avenue in Oak Park, Illinois. And that, of course, was his laboratory for his prairie period. His houses are everywhere in Oak Park.
And so Frank Lloyd Wright met Mamah Borthwick Cheney. And it didn't take long before his visits to check on the building plans turned into something else. Even though both of them were married to other people and both had children, Frank and Mamah fell in love. Nancy Horan put it this way in her novel Loving Frank.
Mamah realized she cared for him for the very reasons he made other people squirm. He was fearlessly outspoken, and he was eccentric, but it was the kind of eccentricity she had come to admire in her father. Anyone as attuned as Frank was to nature's order, anyone raised to reason outside the mainstream, was not going to be penned in very well by society's rules. His ears and eyes and heart were tuned to seek truth in places where other people didn't look.
In this and in so many other ways, she felt a kindred spirit to him.
And Mema may have been the love of Wright's life, his intellectual and spiritual peer. But this great passion raised some serious questions about Wright's architecture. As Drennan says, it's...
an episode drenched in irony. Here you have this champion of domesticity designing a prairie-style house which features the hearth at the center of the coaxial design, the hearth emblematic, of course, of domestic life, designing a house for a family that he intends to destroy.
Wright and Mamie Borthwick, I believe, embarked upon a full-fledged love affair by 1907. And by 1909, they left Oak Park and met up and sailed for Europe together. But they were almost immediately discovered in a hotel in Berlin.
And the newspapers of the day had no doubts about the character of Mema Borthwick Cheney.
People were appalled by her. She was a homewrecker. She was a vampire in the newspaper headlines. You know, how does a woman leave her children?
If this relationship had been just an affair, it might have burned itself out over time. But several years went by, long enough for Wright to build the ultimate prairie house, Taliesin, in Spring Green, Wisconsin, where he intended to live with Mema and her children. Mema's influence on Wright is unmistakable. William Drennan.
Taliesin is distinctly Wrightian. It's the apotheosis of the culmination of the prairie house. It's made out of organic material indigenous to the area. It is distinctly horizontal. It is built into, not on top of, a hill. What makes it different, I suppose, the most marked difference, is that no longer is that coaxial design with the hearth at the heart of the residential design at Taliesin. The living room is, and one stands in that living room, and one gets a sense of being almost suspended in air and suspects that the architectural argument implicitly going on is that here, at last, here is a place where the imperial self can be expressed in an unfettered sort of way.
His architecture changed in a variety of ways, but in particular, well, he calls Taliesin his first truly organic house, but he no longer was putting decorative screens of leaded glass in his home. He put clear panes of large glass so that that sense of connection was truly stronger at Taliesin. And the garden, of course. He called her Mema of the Hills, and he called her Mema of the Garden. She liked to take long walks, and she loved to garden.
Nancy Horan perfectly captures the mood of this happy idyll at Taliesin, when Frank and Mema, happy with their work and each other, are living quietly in the country. She read me a passage from Loving Frank, where they're spending an evening translating Goethe.
A hymn to nature. Nature, we are encompassed and enveloped by her, powerless to emerge and powerless to penetrate deeper. They sat on the sofa facing the window. The little Goethe book lay between them. Mema moved her finger over the third line of the poem, then wrote quickly on the paper in her lap. Unbid and unforewarned, she read. Awfully stiff right off the bat, Frank said, scratching his scalp. How about unbidden and unwarned? Sounds better. She wrote the correction above the line, then translated the next line. Into the gyrations of her dance she lifts us, whirling and swirling us onward until exhausted from her arms we fall. Frank looked over at the paper she held. Gyrations is harsh, don't you think? It suggests a dervish, that line. I think this whole idea of our dance with life, it's gentler than that, more like a waltz. Mema pensively tapped her mouth with the pencil. Don't put lead on those lips, he said. She wrote some words, crossed out others. How is this? She said a minute later. Unbidden and unwarned, she takes us up in the round of her dance and sweeps us along until, exhausted, we fall from her arms. He pushed a long strand of dark hair behind her ear. Lovely, he said.
One of the things I love about that is that previous pictures of Frank Lloyd Wright show him as a peremptory man, perhaps, a man who didn't tolerate much in the way of criticism. Here you have a scene in which there is give and take. This is two people treating each other as equals. they really did see each other as each other's true love, and that's not the way we usually hear the story.
Right. I believe they did. I think he saw her as his peer, his equal. She was a highly intelligent woman, very cultivated, said to have been able to hold her own in any salon. She was comfortable in the realm of ideas, as he was. They lived that kind of life where they talked about ideas. She was very much interested in the rights of the individual, particularly the rights of individual women to develop their own gifts. And Frank Lloyd Wright was, of course, very much concerned with the individual and was intent upon developing an architecture that celebrated democratic ideals and the ideals of the individual.
And then this peaceful idyll is shattered by an act of unspeakable violence. Frank Lloyd Wright was away in Chicago. Mama was home with her son John and daughter Martha. There were several draftsmen and other workmen in residence, and a young African-American named Julian Carlton, who worked as a butler, general servant, and handyman. His wife, Gertrude, was the cook. There was no warning, and no good explanation for what then happened. William Drennan has researched the story, and this is his best guess.
I think what happened was that Julian Carlton came up behind Mama as she and her family bent over their midday soup, that he drove a hatchet of a type called a shingling hatchet deep into her skull. He seems then to have killed her young son, John. He then chased down Martha and dispatched her. I think that he then went over to where the workmen were. He then calmly served the workmen their soup, closed the door to the roughly 12-foot by 12-foot room that they, in a makeshift fashion, were using for their dining hall, that he locked it from the outside, that he poured gasoline from Wright's garage under the door, and that he then lit a match and dropped it into the gasoline. The result, of course, was an instantaneous explosion within that room, and all the men were on fire, howling living torches.
The perpetrator of this carnage, Julian Carlton, then drank a bottle of acid and crawled away, already dying, to hide on the Taliesin grounds. We can only speculate on what prompted these horrific murders. William Drennan has found some indications of mental illness in Carlton's past, but he says we may have to look elsewhere for a motive.
If we're going to speak about motive, we have to speak as well about the endemic racism of the day. While there, and he was only there a short time, he'd been hired in mid-June 1914, along with Gertrude, his wife. And the explosion, of course, occurred in mid-August. But while there, even that brief time, he was subjected to a fair number of racial epithets, especially from the mouth of one of the draftsmen, Emile Brodel. I suspect at the end of the day that when we speak of motivation in terms of the Taliesin murders, we can say with a fair degree of confidence that Julian Carlton wanted Emile Brodel dead, and he didn't want anybody else around to tell the tale.
The victims of the Taliesin massacre far outnumbered the fatalities. The peaceful, bucolic community of Spring Green had never experienced such a terrifying and tragic shock. In fact, it took decades before the Taliesin murders were eclipsed as Wisconsin's deadliest, and one of the victims was Frank Lloyd Wright himself. William Drennan says the murders radically transformed his architecture.
All that is fortress-like about the Prairie House becomes accentuated in the aftermath of the Taliesin murders. They become ever more insular, ever more isolated, and I suppose we understand why that may have been.
There's no question that Frank grieved terribly for Mama. Novelist Nancy Horan says even Wright's children from his abandoned marriage could see how vital Mama was to him.
I believe that she was a good influence on him. And I know that his son, John Lloyd Wright, wrote a book about his father in which he said, "Something loving and gentle in my father died with her. Something I loved about my father. She was a noble woman."
Nancy Horan. Her novel about Frank Lloyd Wright and Mama Borthwick Cheney is called Loving Frank. But the last word belongs to William Drennan.
The astonishing thing, of course, is that his life, his creative life, his artistic life does not end there. The more productive half of that artistic life still lies before him.
William Drennan's book is called Death in a Prairie House, Frank Lloyd Wright and the Taliesin Murders. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you want to hear this program again, check an author's name, or find out about a piece of music we used, visit our website. It's ttbook.org. To buy a copy of the program, just call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 129B, Cultural Touchstones. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Mary Lou Finnegan, with help from Ann Strainchamps, Doug Gordon, Veronica Rickert, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.